scores was very narrow. Conclusions were that marble murrelets frequently reoccupy nesting sites, whether it's individuals or different individuals reusing an area. This occurs at a variety of scales. The fidelity at the scale, looking at individuals that return or birds that reuse individual trees or branches, there's some evidence that it may be lower, the likelihood may be lower in areas with more continuous habitat, but the data are really too limited at this point to identify the spatial extent of fidelity within large areas of contiguous habitat. The data gap is that, particularly at the scale of the stand, we were unable to really determine relationships between fidelity and the extent of continuous habitat or the acreage of habitat. It was not present in the studies that we examined, and therefore there's an additional need to try to get at that information that may be available in unpublished or in unanalyzed data at this point. But it is an identified need and a gap in our knowledge at this point. In addition, information on marked individuals would enable us to better determine individual fidelity and also potentially differences between males and females in their likelihood of returning to a site. Question three, no, these are not marble murrelets, but does give an indication that at least in some species, getting an idea of density and co-occurrence within a given area can be a little bit easier. So how does the spatial extent of continuous potential habitat relate to the co-occurrence of murrelets in a stand? We identified only 14 studies that had primary data analyses. Six of these did identify areas of continuous habitat, but only one of them actually quantified habitat area. And again, low evaluation score. Most of these results, again, were descriptive or anecdotal. And similar to the previous two, we had very little variation in the total study evaluation scores that were obtained. Should note that almost all the variation in study evaluation scores was due to those confidence criteria. The relevance criteria tended to be even more narrowly focused than the overall ones. So we did not split up by relevance and confidence. So for question three, there was evidence for co-occurrence of murrelets at watershed and forest stand levels that we were looking at. Studies were not comprehensive in surveying an entire stand or watershed for nests. Again, this is a very difficult process. However, it's worth pointing out here that we found no studies that we were able to determine from reading through that they were entirely comprehensive. Therefore, the frequency of co-occurrence can only be considered minimal from what we found. As with the previous question, the relationship between the extent of habitat and the probability of occurrence or even determining a breeding density within a stand or a watershed was not possible from the studies that are available. So in order to get a sense of the total number of nests within an area, intensive tree climbing efforts would be required within both the contiguous and non-contiguous habitat to answer this question fully. There's information that still needs to be obtained on actually determining the density of concurrently active nests Again, a difficult process. There's a need to quantify the extent of continuous habitat at the watershed and forest stand scales where co-occurrence occurs in order to actually determine these relationships. And likewise, the nest density and associations with habitat area, total amount of habitat within areas of various scales remains a data gap. Question four relates to the number and size of potential platforms and platform tree densities within stands. And we also look to determine whether or not such relationships may differ among different age classes. We had 25 studies that had primary data or analyses. However, we did omit 11 others that were considered to have been superseded by analyses, broader analyses by Hamer, Nelson, and Baker et al. We did not find any studies that provided specific information on stand age that could be used within the studies themselves that could be used to address the question. There's very limited information on younger stands to begin with. This, as you'll see, remains a data gap. The scores were somewhat higher. Again, this is a more quantitative question, so there were more studies that actually did have a broader range of analyses that were considered in answering it. However, the majority still were descriptive or anecdotal, and as with the others, often sample sizes were one. Our list. Again, a broader range of evaluation scores, and so then we were able to actually look at and see how scores pertain to some of the conclusions. However, in this case, we did not find any bias in the results associated with the scores. One of the problems in addressing and trying to do a meta-analysis or more quantitative analysis of this question is that there was variability among the studies in the methods and also in the definitions of platforms that were used. So our ability to compare among different studies was highly limited. We were able to come up with a minimal and mean nest limb diameters. Again, this will not surprise anybody in this room, most likely, that these numbers were seven, minimal nest limb diameter of 7 centimeters and a mean of 26 measured at the bowl and 10 and 28 centimeters measured at the nest. Most of the studies indicated that nest trees typically contain more nesting platforms than non-nest or randomly selected trees within a patch or stand, and that the evidence for the density of trees containing potential nest platforms as a predictor of nesting probability is equivocal. Some studies seem to indicate that there was an association, others did not, and this did not vary with the evaluation scores of these studies. One of the key data gaps is that at least what's available in studies and published studies and others that are available at this point is that there really were no data found for nests that have been discovered since 2003. Obviously, that data does exist. It just wasn't in any of the in any of the studies that we had available. There have not been studies to date that have looked at variability associated with stand age classes, as well as elevation, which may be a important factor here. And the last question pertains to nesting success in relation to habitat characteristics. This is a much more general question, and as such had far more studies, 40 studies. Three of these were omitted because even though they had information on nesting success, they only contained information on disturbance or loss of nests that were associated with human disturbance. We chose to exclude those. 16 of these studies actually were analyses that were conducted looking at the associations between habitats with nest fates. The others were more descriptive, and they included information on nesting habitat and information on nest success, but were not set up to actually look at associations between those features. Five of the 40 studies included or focused on studies of artificial Marlborough millet nests, and one study contained information that actually compared results on artificial and actual millet nests. Again, somewhat higher evaluation scores. These were driven largely by these analytical studies that actually had some statistical approaches to looking at these relationships. The descriptive studies, however, tended to have very small sample sizes. Now, again, list there. Again, a broader range of study evaluation scores. So the model selection and analyses seem to be the most useful ones that were present in identifying that we were reviewing that identified variables of interest and interactions among these variables in relation to nesting success. However, these studies varied widely on which variables were included, and so that sort of limited comparability across across studies. One of the key questions that popped up in many of the studies with the analyses was identifying and or considering the relationship between nest success and the distance to the edge of a nesting stand. And the general conclusions was that these relationships were variable, often due to interactions with other habitat characteristics, such as the type of the edge, hard edge, soft edge, and adjacent the type of adjacent habitat, as well as predator densities that were associated with the different habitats. Again, there were a lot of studies that were descriptive that had information that did not actually enable an analysis within the study itself of the relationships between the habitat characteristics and nest success. However, these did provide information that perhaps could be used in a meta-analysis in the future with additional information. Some of the data gaps were that many of these studies differed regionally, so the comparisons were somewhat difficult, so some more coordination across different regions of the species range would be helpful in actually addressing some of these questions. And then these interaction terms between the different variables often co-varied within studies, or the variables often co-varied within studies, so actually trying to piece apart the important variables remains a feature that would be important to explore further. So just sort of an overview across all of the questions that I wanted to conclude with here was that the questions pertain to the extent of habitat and the associations with various characteristics of Marlborough millet breeding are still not well studied at this point. The information that's out there, at least in available studies, does not provide as much information as one would like to be able to really address these questions fully, particularly sizes of stands, sizes of habitat areas, and distances within those areas are key elements that are still lacking. The relationship between ages of different stands, again, this as with the previous point, there probably almost certainly is information that's available that can be applied to known nest sites and existing data. However, the relationships have not been described or examined in studies to date at a level that we can draw any general conclusions. Lack of controlled studies, especially for a review of this sort, makes it difficult to fully assess and come up with overall, especially quantitative conclusions. It's difficult for many of these questions given the system. However, it is something to consider how to approach in the future. The comparability of results, again, just due to geographic differences among ranges of studies of different habitat types, it was often quite difficult for us to be able to draw any conclusions, specific conclusions. Sample sizes are small. They will probably continue to be small, but again, perhaps designing studies and setting it up in a way that meta-analyses can be considered will enable us to address these questions more fully. And finally, there is quite a bit of unpublished data. I mean, some of it are in studies that have not been published, but beyond that, there's a tremendous amount of raw data that is available that, given the opportunity, probably could be addressed and could be used to address these questions more fully. And again, a little bit larger print is the website for those of you that have not seen the report to date. And I think that's where we'll cut it off for now.
Great. So why don't we take about a 7-minute break and then come back and we'll make John answer any questions that you have. And then before I forget, we do have the OSU research team here, and after sort of the Q&A, I've asked Jim Rivers to give an overview. They have a windfall of money to fund some Merlet research, so he's just going to give an overview of kind of what their plans are moving forward with those research dollars. So come back here by that clock at 2:17. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm like, what? Something's grabbing me now.
Questions for John?
Really covered
all that.
Okay.
All right.
Well, so you mentioned there was a lack of controlled studies, and I just wanted you to go into more detail on what that is, and if you had any recommendations for what those might look like. Do you need experimental studies?
Generally, yes. I mean, experimental with, but such as a possibility would be a result of a management decision on nesting. Or on bringing nests into an area. So, but yeah, just as far as sort of a designed experiment that's focused on answering a particular question. I mean, there are some out there that particularly relating to some of the habitat associations that have looked at direct associations by looking in different habitats and making those comparisons. So it doesn't need to be experimental necessarily.
Did you come across any manipulative studies that actually changed the stand level forest structure or landscape?
Could you repeat the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. So could you repeat the question?
Okay.
I was wondering if you came across any experimental studies. Okay.
So the question is whether or not I came across any, or we came across any experimental studies at either the landscape or stand level. Not as far as habitat manipulation was concerned. that were directly geared toward particular questions. Again, you know, there were studies, particularly Canadian studies, that did look at results of habitat changes. And feel free to hop in if anybody has counter information or additional information. Jeff.
Jonathan, on question one, you reiterated a couple of times the fact that there were no studies at sites with potential habitat and confirmed absence of nests. This is the behavior, circling
right.
behavior and
yes.
such. By that, do you mean that the studies revealed that there were those behaviors at active nest sites, but there was no one looking at potential habitat where you didn't know the nests?
No. It's part of the issue is that in trying to determine association between behaviors and nesting, there's lots of information that behaviors do occur at known nesting areas. The question becomes, do those behaviors also occur at non-nesting
right.
areas?
Right.
And so then what we found, at least what was available, was that we didn't find any studies that included information that said, there's habitat here, we know for sure that there are no nests here, and behaviors were not observed, murrelets were not observed in these locations. So that's the key element that's missing, and it's very difficult to confirm. I mean, there were studies that said that no nests were found, but there weren't occasions where it was said with a degree of certainty that just because they're not found, it wasn't clear if the intensiveness of the monitoring or the nest searching was such that it could be concluded, especially at a larger scale, that murrelets did not occur there.
So the flip of that would be, question might be, for the sites that they did observe those behaviors, were they certain that nests were at those sites?
Yes, so those we included.
So
we only included if there was certainty of nests or certainty of non-nests.
Okay. Yeah, because if others go out and they survey and they see the behavior and they assume that there's a nest there because that's what you're supposed to infer from the behavior, then you're not contributing to that knowledge base.
Right,
you just,
right.
Okay.
So, and as Kim has pointed out, that there were sites in which no nests were found, but at least during the course of the study and reported in the study, but during subsequent work at those sites, nests were identified. So that's why it's difficult to confirm no nests.
What was the general scale of a watershed? I mean, a watershed, in my mind, can be dramatically different in the studies you looked at.
Highly variable. It could be a single basin or a large stream, river basin in Canada. We were not specific on that. When we had the information on quantification of it, we included it. But we were basically just looking at for something at a level larger than a stand. Okay, did we find that the studies were well distributed? Yeah, in relation to distance from ocean or foraging areas. I couldn't really answer that. I don't think. You know, I think it varied geographically. There's I know that we had some more inland sites than coastal and some or in a few studies, but I don't know what the distribution was overall. Distance from coast was one of the factors that we looked at in the last question, though. So
yeah,
distance from foraging area.
Greater than 35 miles. So-called inland
Yeah. There's a lack of data from a lot of areas, specific areas. They tend to be focused, and a lot of the information are focused on the same areas over and over for obvious reasons.
It seems that it's important to keep in mind that, am I right, that half of this mission is to try to help kind of validate a systematic review process, or just verify whether a systematic review process is helpful in such a environment that's so much different than an RCT environment for
yes.
medicine. And are you prepared to comment about that to the board or the governor?
Sure. Bring him on. bring her on. Well, we actually will have a sort of lessons learned meeting that will be coming up that the team will get together and discuss the pros and cons as well as the different elements. I think that there are certainly opportunities. Until you really have a good feel for the data, it's hard to tell how effective the process will be. I believe, but without knowing such issues as how comparable and a lot of the studies are going to be. So it's sort of hard to do beforehand. I think, obviously, this is not a species that lends itself to data-rich, especially large sample sizes, I should say. In many of the studies, and that becomes problematic. One of the ways of approaching it that we did not take simply because we were following sort of established approaches that have been used before as far as defining those criteria, is that it might be better in a situation like this with these sorts of questions, or at least with some of them, to think more broadly about the factors that are used to identify or to evaluate studies. There are difficulties, and I think questions can be honed differently, and it will depend. But I think we certainly learned quite a bit through this process about how to take this approach. Perhaps some of the questions are more amenable to it than others. Yeah, Dan.
John, are there differences between systematic evidence review as a process and systematic review, or is systematic review just a shorthand for systematic evidence review?
I'm sorry, so differences between just a general review versus an evidence review?
Are there subtle differences, or are they essentially the same?
They're essentially the same as far as I'm aware, yeah. They're just, you'll see SR or SER used interchangeably.
So SR is just shorthand for SER.
Yeah, lazy.
It's acronym for the acronym.
Yeah. I mean, the CE doesn't differentiate between them.
Okay. Another question. A couple of times in the report and in your presentation, you mentioned the existence of a lot of unpublished data that could be brought to bear on some of the key questions. And I wondered if you saw a signal in the review of, is there a reason why those data are unpublished? Or do you recommend that somebody actually seek them out and try and address some of these questions more quantitatively?
Yeah.
In other words, is there publication bias here? Or is it sort of the peer review process working well and keeping poor studies out of the literature?
I think I can kind of repeat that question. So basically, noting that there are quite a few unpublished data that were unpublished studies that were included here, that there are a number of them that are out there. The question is whether or not this is a result of the potential the publication bias, or if it's actually the peer review process that's keeping out poor studies. Is that essentially it?
Yeah, basically.
More or less.
Can we recommend people go and try and take this data up and use them, or is this something we should kind of keep, covered up?
No. No, I think, I mean, the information, there's good information out there. And even as I mentioned, I mean, our evaluation process was for particular questions, as they pertain to particular questions, and not a reflection of, you know, of what we thought of the studies as a whole. Obviously, a lot of these studies are results of reports. A lot of the unpublished ones are reports that went in. There may be some issues with ownership with the data, but there's always a problem that there's more publishable information that just never makes it into press than can. It may be. What's that?
Oh, I was going to say when you're done, I can answer.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm sure Kib can. And some of these are interim reports. A lot of them were interim studies that did get into the literature eventually. There's always a problem these days trying to publish anything with small sample sizes. And the nature of Merlet work, at least from, you know, individual investigators, is often that it's too narrow to be accepted in a lot of publications. I mean, I think probably with online opportunities, there will be more opportunities to get information out there. I think it's a combination. But yes, there's a lot of unpublished data that and unpublished studies that can be reworked to be publication quality. Kim, do you want to finish?
Yeah, this is Kim Nelson. Yeah, I just wanted to address that. Yeah, the date that he gave for the last nest that was analyzed was 2003, at least outside of BC, and then there was one study in Washington, Bloxon and Raphael, and one study in California, Haber and Golightly, where they had found nests more recent than that. So there's a whole bunch of nests out there that have never been in any report or paper because they were found opportunistically. So combining all those data together would be great. And also, yeah, it was a small sample size mostly. So right now, Tom Hamer and I are working together on our separate studies, combining our data together. It's funded by NICASI to publish some data that never were published because we had such small sample sizes. So if you look at where the early Merlet data was published, it's like Northwestern Naturalist. Where are you going to put it when you have a sample size of 4? So it was sample size driven and question driven and money driven. But if all of those data that exist out there, including the hundreds of nests, nobody has combined all the data together to really look at it and use those data in good ways. So there's certainly tons of room for doing some retrospective studies on the existing data.
And the other aspect of that, too, is that, again, with the early data, the techniques, the analytical techniques, especially of spatial-type questions, have increased so much that going back to some of the original data and being able to apply GIS analyses would really be able to address some of these questions more fully and in a more publishable manner. Dan. No, Dan's got one.
So, John, this is 2020 hindsight, I realize. And I realize that you guys had limited resources, like most studies, to do this systematic review. But given what you found at the end of the process of reviewing what was available, and given a lot of the equivocation that had to occur in listing conclusions from the limited available results in the publications and great literature that you were able to review, do you think it might have been a good idea to include marbled murrelet studies from outside of the three-state area, or include at least as information contributing to the overall conclusions, studies from other fairly closely related ALCIDs, or what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do. One, we did include from throughout the range of the species. So, in fact, a lot of the studies were were from were Canadian studies, BC studies, and we also had one or two Alaska studies that pertained. So we'd use the relevance factor to sort of identify those and ones that were in different habitat that differed more from Oregon, Washington type habitats would lose a point essentially. But no, those were included. From other closely related alcids, so many. We did look at long-billed merlets. I don't believe that we included any. We may have missed one or two that we didn't have translations for, which falls on us, certainly. The ones that were available, fell out of the inclusion process. For the rest, our feeling was after much discussion of it, we really felt that because we were focused on tree nesting habitat down here and relationship to tree nesting and not dense alcid types of associations, we really wanted to keep it narrowly focused. And we really, we could have extended probably to Kittlitz's, given more opportunity to do so, but even then we would have to take into consideration some of the potential differences between them and somehow and rank those differently. I thought about it more, and certainly Kim and I have had several discussions on this with the inclusion of other alcids, and it kind of occurred to me that if we were asking a question about what types of nests marble merlets used, what sorts of structures they used, if we were basing that on what we knew of other alcids, we would say they couldn't nest in trees. We have to be careful when we're including other species that don't share that characteristic and certain what would be key characteristics or associations with some of these with some of the questions that we're asking.
Yeah. Well, certainly that's true of question four, right? I mean,
that's probably obviously question four, but
what about maybe question two?
Question
Which
two
is a really tough one
with fidelity.
Marbled merlets.
It is. It's extremely tough. I agree. And that's why we at least broadened it out to include just reuse, not just fidelity.
Right.
I mean, there are, there's marking techniques or something along that line. And again, this may be just as technology becomes better for us to be able to track birds, track individuals longer, we may be able to address it in a better sense or, along that line. It's a very tough question, and I think we went into this process realizing that it was likely that a lot of our key results were going to be identifying these data gaps, identifying where the information is lacking, and maybe some of it's available that hasn't been analyzed or published. But in other cases, it's where we really need to think harder about how to address these questions, if we can, and recognize that some of them may be very difficult. And then, we can step back and say, okay, well, best available science is to be a little more inclusive of the way that we're addressing these questions. But we chose not to for this.
The systematic review process, though, is it's supposed to be rather brutal. It's supposed to exclude, kind of aggressively exclude, to rely on publication filtering, exclude data that doesn't line up well. So as you get used to this process, eventually you'll be able to spot whether this is a smart endeavor at all, and it just isn't the data there to draw conclusions from. You don't want to modify SR to start letting weaker data leak in, or you're not really doing a governed systematic review anymore.
Right. It really comes down to defining the question itself and making, how narrowly you define the question. So when we said, we were in the questions themselves that we were asking about marble merlets, that was our way of not including, saying that we weren't including others. So.
On the data gap, obviously each of these questions, you identify a lot of data gaps. And I'm just kind of wondering, in your opinion, is there anything in there that you were sort of surprised hadn't been studied or you think would be relatively important and easy to tackle?
Well, I think for me, thank you. I was really hoping you weren't going to ask me to actually, you know, rank the or prioritize those data gaps. Okay, good, all yours. For me, the first question, it hadn't hit home for me until we started this review that the question of behavioral associates with nesting really requires understanding what's happening where they aren't nesting. We've all seen behaviors, all these behaviors associated with nests, but the fact that there hasn't been, and again, maybe it may just be so difficult to do so, to identify habitat that doesn't have nests present and to determine, if murrelets are through there or identify where murrelets may be going through these areas. Now, again, you run into the problem that they could be prospecting for future sites, but that would be useful information as well to determine whether or not behaviors are associated with that. But that was one gap that struck me in particular. And then regarding a lack of really getting information on these associations with stand size, with habitat area. That information has to be out there to some degree, at least, identifying stand size or habitat area with like questions 2 and 3. And we didn't find any that actually addressed it, were able to address it. So. Jim's turn.
So hearing no further questions for John, I kind of called Jim Rivers yesterday and put him on the spot, and so we should all recognize that the OSU research team is very early in their deliberations, but Jim Rivers is going to tell us about money that OSU has been awarded by the legislature, specifically for Murrelet research, and talk about kind of what they're thinking going forward.
Speaking.
Yeah.
So we just wanted to take this opportunity to kind of let some of you know, if you weren't aware, that we're starting a large-scale murrelet study. The science team is myself, Matt Betts, Dan Roby, and Kim Nelson. And as was just stated, we're still in the very early stages of trying to figure out what sort of questions we're going to be focusing on. One of the things that we want to point out here, and I don't think we can overstate this enough, is that murrelets are extremely difficult to work with. So one of the things that we're focusing our work on is an intensive demography study, and that's going to require capturing birds at sea, which means we have to go out and have all kinds of additional things that you might not think about when capturing murrelets, like survival suits and motherships and zodiacs and all kinds of things. So you can imagine it's a large-scale effort. It's going to be one that we are going to try our best at. But again, the goal here is to try and better understand the demography of murrelets and also to have the work that we're doing be very applicable to managers. So we have different pieces where we're looking at habitat characteristics of where nests will be, assuming that we can get birds captured and tagged and locate those nests. We're looking at predators of nests because we think that, as was indicated in the report, avian nest predators are probably one of the more important nest predators for murrelets. So we have a piece where we're going to be looking at nest predators. And we're hoping to do a management experiment, but there's a lot of moving pieces with that. There's a lot of limitations on what we can and cannot do around a listed species. So that's something that, again, we're still working through. So those are just a couple of things that we're thinking about. If you have questions on the project, I'm the team leader, so feel free to get in touch with me. Before I sit down, is there anything else that I should make sure that I include?
Talk about the cooperators and the fact that everybody will hear about this and see the proposal, I think.
Yeah, so what Kim had mentioned is that we actually have an advisory group that we've been working with, represented by ODF and some others, and we're working with them to, again, to make sure that this research is as applicable to managers as possible. And that process, we're expecting that to go through the fall, probably till the beginning of the new year, and at that point we'll be able to share with everyone exactly what we're doing, give you the nuts and bolts. If it sounds like we're still researching our questions, we absolutely are. We're finding all that we can about different types of satellite tags and radio telemetry tags, and I'm learning that there are some tags that actually can stay on a bird, or at least can work for over a year, and if we can have those tags on a bird, we might actually be able to see what's going on from one year to the next, which is obviously important for breeding fidelity. But again, we don't know if those tags will stay on for a full year. There's a lot of issues with tag attachment once the birds go through molt. So lots of these things we're going to be researching now in this first year. First 2 years really are going to be pilot years to see what we can do. And then the hope is that we can move through time, get additional funding to kind of hone what we're doing and start hitting those other topics as well. Any questions? Thanks.
Well, I think that's it for the afternoon. So I want to thank everybody for coming. And I guess, you know, more to come through the OSU work. And, you know, obviously we're not done. We haven't figured out Marble Mill yet. So thanks for coming. And the audio and the PowerPoint will be on the same website address that John put.
These presentations we
have. I think we can get it.
I can get it. Yeah.